This is King Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on June 2nd, 2010. Tonight's guests are Jeff Cohen, who is the author of Rails for .NET Developers and a hockey fanatic, Michael Moore, who's a developer husband, father, podcaster, Ruby zealot, and Mountain West RubyConf organizer, and Mr. Scott Belware, who's been on before, and so we don't need to introduce him.
Jeff, are you a Rails core committer as well?
I have done a couple of small contributions, but not lately. I wish I could say that I've done more, but it's been hard to contribute into that community lately.
And tonight's topic, before I was so rudely interrupted by Scott K's question, tonight's topic, what we're trying to get to the bottom of here is why certain developers leave the Microsoft ecosystem for different areas, whether it be going into Python or going into Ruby on Rails development, just trying to find out if this is because of technology or because of culture or legal things or philosophical disagreements with the Microsoft entity. So maybe we could just go around and talk about starting with Jeff and just give us a little bit of background on your career and when you made the switch over.
Yeah, I started using Ruby mid-late 2005. I'd been a long-time Microsoft developer writing Windows desktop apps in C++ and then later C#. But by 2006, I completely switched over to Rails. And when I look back on kind of why I made that kind of drastic switch, there are a few things I tend to pick up on. One was the Ruby language itself. I mean, I remember reading back then, I think it was a Martin Fowler article about Rake or something where he was mentioning the scripting language called Ruby. And I just thought it was some toy language or something. I really didn't give it half a thought. But the more I looked into it and I discovered that, hey, you know, it's really a fully object-oriented language and had this weird dynamic typing thing, which I wanted to learn about. That was the first pull for me. And then when I started to get into Rails and all of the guidelines and conventions that you kind of got out of the box for free, it was kind of like just a nice breath of fresh air compared to the ASP.NET that I had been trying to learn instead.
Let's keep going around and ask Mike about his background.
I think that my descent away from the .NET platform was pretty well chronicled on the Alt.NET podcast. As much as I tried to kind of distance myself from evangelizing Ruby, I pretty much just ended up doing that anyway. For me, it was, I think it follows Jeff's pattern pretty close. I started in .NET in late 2000, back before when it was still beta, before it was released. I think the first app we released was on the Go Live beta license before it was actually out. It was a website that we did. And I had just been, you know, actively involved in the .NET community ever since that point in time. And then it was like December of 2004 or early spring of 2005 when I saw Kurt Hibbs' O'Reilly article about Rails giving you a 10 times increase in productivity. And I thought, well, any self-respecting web guy should, you know, be able to talk intelligently about that claim. And so I started looking into it and I found, you know, the conventions over configuration and all these other things I've been talked about a lot the last 5 years. But what really hooked me was Ruby. And that's what's really kind of kept me in the Ruby community for so long and what keeps me here today. So I think that was kind of the start of it. And it was just an eventual kind of falling away from .NET ever since. You know, it's just not Ruby. And that's really where I want to be right now. And that's pretty much it. Scott?
Yeah, and Scott B., do you still straddle both worlds or?
that's a colorful image. I do straddle both worlds. I use .NET because I know it, but I use it for very specific things where it's good. I tend to see C# more like, you know, it's kind of like a Java to me now. You know, it now that it runs on multiple platforms, that there's a perfectly open source version of it that is free to innovate faster than what Microsoft can innovate on its sort of larger and say larger, more complex release schedules. You know, you don't get a new version of .NET unless they can rev, you know, Visual Studio and SQL Server and SharePoint and, you know, and God knows 100 other things now that go into it. But more and more of my time, I think, is spent in Ruby. I think progressively, you know, over the last 3 years, you know, my .NET use has been inversely proportional to my Ruby and Rails use. And I think that's, you know, that's true because I like to work in web apps. I think if I was building platform apps, you know, once you're building platform apps, you have a different set of questions to answer. And if I'm looking at platform apps, then I'll probably, you know, C# is what I know. I might choose to use that, but there's still a really phenomenal number of options for using Ruby on thick client apps now too. So it's not really clear anymore to me where I would use C# and .NET or CLI or not. I'm not a WPF, WCF kind of guy. So there's, you know, I don't really have any reason necessarily. And some of the new stuff like, you know, like Mac Ruby would be more interesting to build Mac desktop apps. But if I was building a Windows desktop app, which I don't, it'd probably be a smart idea. You know, .NET's a good, and when I mean .NET, I mean like Microsoft's implementation of the CLI. You know, that's a pretty smart choice for building Windows apps, Windows client apps. You know, I think once you look at server apps, it starts to become really, really fuzzy. And when you really start looking into it and you don't consider the power of something like Rails or even Django or even PHP, and I, you know, it's kind of like just following a habit that you've grown so used to that you fail to you know, ask questions about it, you know.
Right.
And for me, you know, that goes back all the way to, you know, like Mike, for me, it started with .NET Beta 1. And, you know, I really, really started doing, you know, test-driven development at that point with NUnit Beta 1 and sort of shifting out of my time in brief time in Java and started one of the first user groups in .NET user groups in August of that year. And was, you know, I worked with INETA and was the chairman of the speaker bureau with INETA for about a year and a half, helped to build one of the most remarkable communities, I think, in the .NET community. I think Austin is pretty well known as a town of smart people. My goal was never to be like a .NET contrarian. But I think over time, there has been a lot of lethargy. You know, you asked if there's philosophical issues, and there's definitely philosophical issues and differences. I mean, dealing with Microsoft is a very, very painful thing sometimes, the way that Microsoft has to ship products and the way its habits of doing product development in a vacuum can lead to some pretty disastrous consequences. And that's really, really turned me on to open source. You know, like I really wasn't, you know, I could really, you know, care, you know, I didn't really care either way about open source. Open source to me was just, you know, and NUnit was open source. It's just, it wasn't about using open source. It was about, you know, using a test-driven development tool. But over time, you know, it actually has become, I've seen the validity of the arguments that I used to think were just a bunch of, you know, harebrained hippies, you know, kvetching about, you know, Microsoft and proprietary software. But there's an incredible amount of truth to the power of open source and, you know, be it Rails or anything else.
I've always thought that was an interesting argument to hear from Rails programmers, especially ones that switch from Windows to Rails. They would go off on the rant of, you know, the philosophical objection to their proprietary platform, and then they would do it so by blogging from their Mac. And you know, I always wondered why, you know, if you really believe in freedom that much, why don't you just, you know, go Debian? I mean, you know, I've tried doing Rails dev and Ruby work on all three platforms, all three major ones. Mm-hmm. By that I mean Nix based ones, Linux and OS X and OS X. Sorry, I don't want the, oh God, now the Apple guys are going to call again. And Windows, and it definitely is easier on Macs than it is on Linux. But once you, if you're not afraid to you know, use autoconf and make from the command line, I found that setting up Ruby and Rails on both OS X and Linux was pretty comparable.
I've never really run Linux as my day-to-day box. I switched off of Windows at Vista. I mean, Vista to me was just, it was, you know, hey, we've got this really crappy product. We've sunk bazillions of dollars into it. We can't not sell it. So we're going to go out in the world and we're going to tell the world, you know, we as Microsoft, we're going to go out in the world and tell the world that this is a good product. And it was obviously not. That absence of integrity and courage at that point in the game was, I think, the tipping point for me was, you know, this is a company I've stood behind for many years, a company I've worked with for a long time, been on the inside, been not on the inside, not as an employee, but been an insider in the MVP program. But even, you know, even the MVP program started becoming a different thing when Microsoft started shipping, you know, really bad products and needed ever more commitments from members of the community to give their vote of approval to stuff that was simply not good. And that to me was that to me was pretty devastating. But I'm thankful for that because it actually, you know, I had to start looking elsewhere. And when I started looking elsewhere, you start to see holes in the I started to see holes in my own beliefs. And it took me, you know, a good long time. I think Mike, you know, made that transition a lot faster, and obviously Jeff did as well. But it took me a good long time to just really accept that my life was going away, that my day-to-day work life and my career life was going away from .NET. And that's a really, really, that was a really, really frightening thing. You know, that was like a, you know, that was like coming out to my friends.
Have you come out?
I'm totally out. Yeah. I'm Rails. I'm Rails all day, all night, baby.
Oh, Rails. Okay.
Oh yeah. Oh, that. No.
You really resisted it for a long time. Cause we've talked on and off for a few years now, and it was always something that you were just not quite ready to just take that final step, you know?
So I was thinking about that. And actually, you know, I remember cause Jeff, I think you guys were at Lone Star RubyConf a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? Am I right?
I don't think I was.
Okay. Well, I think it was one of you that might have been there. Not one of the many you, but
one of the softies.
Yeah. But I remember people bugging me about this all the time. And it was a message that they kept sending to me. Why don't you just do Rails full time? Why don't you just do Rails? And I think, Mike, that's what you're talking about. And this went on for 2 years. And it shows to me that it's really, really possible to hear something, you know, to have the sound waves going into your ears, to have the, you know, to register it in your brain and simply not hear it at all. And again and again and again, people kept telling me, why don't you just go? Why don't you just leave to Rails? Why don't you just do this full time? I mean, you know how to do it. Go do it. And it really never clicked. And then one day it was just like, what the hell? You know, they've been saying this forever. But it was a gradual thing. And I'll say this much, and I know how it feels for other developers who, you know, folks like myself and Mike, who are, you know, have had periods of evangelizing Ruby to .NET developers. It's hard to hear it because you have to look at your life and go, this is where it's basically security. And it takes a little bit of willingness to stare down the unknown and say, I'm doing this because it's good. I'm doing this for me. And my life's going to be better after a little bit of pain. And it's a big, you know, it's a big psychological hurdle, but it's only a psychological hurdle, right? There's no technical reason not to, and there's every technical reason to do it, but there's just this psychological hurdle in there that's saying, oh my God, you know, and it's really fear, and it's, you know, and we deny the fear for a long time until it clicks.
That's exactly what I was going to say. In my experiences talking to a lot of .NET folks, it really is fear. It's not necessarily fear of the unknown, but I think there's this real insular kind of culture that you get within the .NET world. And they're just, you know, a lot of the guys that I worked with and I would have conversations with were just really hesitant to even look outside of the Iron Curtain at anything else that was going on. I mean, this is, you know, not even so much about like, you know, jumping ship and going to a completely different community, but even, you know, adopting some of the agile practices or, you know, talking to the .NET guys and figuring out, or the alt.NET guys and figuring out, you know, what they're into and why they're into it. They're just really, really hesitant. And I've never really been able to put my finger on what it was that was causing this fear, but it just seems obvious to me that it was fear-based. They were just scared of something. I'm not really sure what it was.
One thing I think is that they feel invested in the platform. And you see this a lot with some of the bigger names around the .NET community where, you know, they can't just leave and stop because they've invested so much time in on the upgrade, on the new technology treadmill at Microsoft, where, you know, you have to learn the next version of this or the next version of that. Or here they've got a new technology that's going to change the world until they abandon it in 2 years. And then, you know, they also get, there's also a reward system in place. You know, you get to be called a most valuable professional, or, you know, an Ineta community champion, or, you know, eventually, you know, you get invited and schmoozed, you know, at PDC, and you get all, you know, all the parties and stuff, and then you get to present. And so you suddenly, you're a big name and you've kind of invested in this.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's kind of an ego part for some of them at play. Well, I think the other half of that is that you go from being really, really knowledgeable about a technology, and that if you want to switch to a new one, you know, you're essentially dropping pay grades if you go to get, you know, so if I stop now and I go to a Rails shop and I say, hey, I want to be a Rails dev. And they say, okay, what's your Ruby experience? Well, you know, off and on, I've played with it for about 3 years. You know, in my spare time, while I've had kids. So, you know, an hour or so a week, maybe I've gotten to play with it. And, you know, they're going to say, okay, well, we'll start you at the junior level and you can work with these other people. And so it's hard to translate a lot of the skills that you have, especially on the Microsoft platform, to other technologies. Because if you're a Python guru, you can kind of translate over to Ruby, because at least you don't have to learn a whole new, you know, underlying platform, Linux or OS X. But if you're a solid C# Windows person, it's kind of hard to suddenly go to something, you know, maybe nothing about, you know, running Ruby on Linux.
Sure. But I don't think that's typically the case, though. I mean, not your average .NET developer isn't trying to become an Ineta speaker, and they're not trying to become an MVP, right?
I think your average visible .NET developer actually looks at those two specific things as actual career objectives.
Oh, man, I just don't buy that. I mean, the guys I talk to, they're not there. That's not what they're looking for. But, you know, but even so, the whole idea of not wanting to go away from the platform because you made an investment is a fallacy. You don't make an investment in yourself. You always take the experiences that you learn wherever you're at and you apply them to wherever you're going, you know? And I think it's, this outlook is really kind of really frustrating to me, because there's so much energy and just emotional energy that people invest in something that some really big company owns that is not yours, right? And I just, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And the longer I've been away from it, the less sense it makes. I just don't.
So I think I just wanted to say, Mike, I think because if I was one of those people that was, you know, and I know you're not an open source zealot, but for a moment there, you sounded a little bit like, you know, I'm not going to say you misrepresented yourself. I heard you say something else. When you said ownership, I don't really know that it's about Microsoft owning something as much as it is that you cannot make decisions about where the platform is going, you know? And I think maybe I'm projecting this onto you, but...
No, I agree with that. I think that the typical .NET developers that, you know, you and I have worked with for years, they definitely look to Microsoft to tell them how to think and what to do. And
yeah, I don't know,
what technology is and how you're supposed to learn it and how it's supposed to be.
Right. I mean, I imagine, I often wonder what it's like to be like your average, like, because the Microsoft platform is really a software platform, like that's akin to like office equipment in my mind. You know, it's there to make office equipment. It's 21st century office equipment manufacturing. And, you know, that's kind of like being like, you know, and I used to only think about like this about SharePoint, but I think it's the whole stack because it's corporate software development. And it's, you know, it's not that there's no need for corporate, so there's a great need for it. In fact, there's a great need for much better corporate software development. There's an incredible need for more productivity in this time of financial crisis. But I think of what it must be like to be a Microsoft developer and not know any better and not know the difference. It's probably bliss, you know, but I think that, I mean, it simply couldn't work. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, once you've taken the pill, you can't go back. And I'm not to say that I've woken up as a genius and learned all the secret. It's not that, but you know, some of us have, are insatiably chasing after a quest of more productivity, and we arrive at answers that are fundamentally different than what Microsoft has arrived at in terms of productivity. We arrive at, you know, productivity comes through elegant design, elegance in the Edsger Dijkstra interpretation, which is simplicity. Well, let's just go with simplicity, you know. we can't make the .NET platform simple, right? It can't happen. We don't build the .NET platform. We're at the whim of it. And when you get to a certain point in your career where you actually know better ways, let's say, categorically better ways to do some of the things that the .NET framework does, it becomes pretty darn heartbreaking. You know, my big thing a couple years ago was Entity Framework. It was bloody heartbreaking to see where ORM was going to go in the .NET space. And really, where it is going in the .NET space as more and more internal teams are required to take dependencies on it. It's because you don't have the ownership, you could be at the cusp of something great and you'll see where the platform is going. When Microsoft makes a decision, that's where the platform goes. And you could already be five steps beyond that. And nonetheless, where the platform goes, the market goes, and where the market goes, your work very likely can go. And it really becomes a matter of having opportunity or equal opportunity and the opportunity to have technical excellence. But that technical excellence is really throttled by Microsoft's product design practices. And hopefully they're changing. And there's been some pretty good changes in product design, but you know they're years away. And I think the problem now is... they're years away, and the pressure's on. You know, there's a lot more pressure now. There's a lot more pressure to perform in the market. What with Apple outpacing Microsoft in market cap, whether you think that's important or not, it's going to create media pressure. It's going to create public pressure, and there's going to be, I think, a lot of panic-stricken decisions made at Microsoft. I think that are actually going to negatively impact product design rather than positively impact it. So I think we should have ownership. And it's not a free software foundation thing for me. It's just, you can't control what's going on in Microsoft. No matter what, you can't control it. And if you do know a better way, it simply doesn't matter. You have to use whatever way you're given. And I think that that's what the freedom is.
Yeah, but you've already got ownership, though. I mean, you like I said before, you are the sum of your experiences. And the more I'm in programming, the more I'm working with other developers, it really doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter what your background is. Doesn't matter what you were working on. It matters if you're a good developer, right? It matters, can you design good code? Can you write good, well-tested code that doesn't break every time something down the line changes, right? And I think I may agree with you, Scott, that there's going to be new pressures on Microsoft, and that may have a negative impact on the .NET community. And I have lots of friends that are still there, and I kind of feel bad that they've got this storm on the horizon potentially. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's just a piece of technology, and we use lots of technology, and you can always move on to something else. You're not stuck. And there's something about the .NET community that makes people think they're stuck and they can't get out.
Well, who said technology treadmill?
That was Scott Kay.
Yeah, Scott Kay used that term, and I think it's a really appropriate term. But the thing is, it's a very nice soft term. You know, the technology treadmill is also, so on one hand, it's innovation, and you get to see a lot of innovation at Microsoft. Very true. They've got a lot of great funding for a lot of interesting avenues of exploration. On the other hand, a technology treadmill is a fear generator. And that's the downside of it. And it's a very, very effective way to keep a captive market. And I'm not trying to speak as a conspiracy theorist. It just is. If you keep instilling rapid change and you keep telling people that they must keep pace, there's absolutely no way for the Microsoft developer to take their eyes off the ball, because that fear is always in play.
Can we back up a second, though, and go back to the ownership topic? Because I kept feeling that it's not as if, sure, none of us are ever going to own the Entity Framework, but it's not like any of us are ever going to own the Apple operating system or the Linux operating system or Rails or anything that we're not the primary committer to or something like that. So is it really about ownership, or is it more about goals and direction and what aligns with your needs?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought Mike was saying about ownership. But the thing is, it's not about, I don't know how Mike feels about this, but it's not about me owning, so my platform lately is Rails. I'm dabbling a little bit in Python now to try to understand some of the amazing scripts that I'm finding out there that do amazing things. But the real issue is that it's owned by a community, and this is not to be a freaky hippie. I'm just saying the community of people who are, let's say, owning Rails, it's a pure meritocracy. It's a absolutely pure meritocracy. The culture is a culture of merit. The best rise to the top. And I have, at the moment, implicit trust in that community, in that meritocracy, because they keep doing really amazing things at a really great pace with really incredible documentation and an absolutely mind-blowing ecosystem. And that meritocracy is not something that you can get out of Microsoft, not because it doesn't want to be a meritocracy, but because it has an internal culture. And that culture is it's the softy culture, you know? It's true. You're going to get the wise manholes round question at your interview culture. I don't really think that the best can rise to the top now in Microsoft culture as it is now. I think it can change, but right now I don't think that's true. I don't think the best of the community can rise to the top because you have to fit in with the softy bureaucracy. And if you don't, you're not going to go there. I mean, they are incredible, incredible software developers, designers, thinkers in the Microsoft community who don't work for Microsoft and who cannot work for Microsoft and continue to do amazing things. And they're doing them in a sphere that they can do them, which is in the open source community.
I don't think Ruby is a pure, or I'm sorry, I don't think Rails is a pure meritocracy. It's pretty close, but it's, you know, there's still a little bit of an, you know, old boys club and who gets to make changes and when and why. But I do agree with Scott that I trust where the Rails community is going a lot more than I trust where Microsoft is going. I think Microsoft is really geared towards satisfying a community, a group of developers, some concerns that I don't personally share. And they're not really going as fast or doing as much as they can. They're not as being as innovative as they can because they're trying to satisfy something else that is not me.
Like Dell, you know, like major corporations, you know, Microsoft drives its products, except in a few occasions, on the input of the biggest companies, you know. And, you know, frankly, the biggest companies' IT shops are simply not the people with the best ideas on how to do IT.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But the other half of that ownership coin, though, is building applications, building like a web framework in .NET is way too complex. It's too big of an endeavor to take on your own. I would have no problem sitting down and saying, you know what, Rails isn't the uber solution I was hoping for. There's a couple of things that just annoy the crud out of me. So I'm going to build my own framework. And I would have no problem going forward with that in Ruby. Mm-hmm. Doing that in .NET, I think, is just too big. Mm-hmm. And there's just too many moving pieces that you don't control. And so you're really kind of, you're handcuffed. You're really limited to what you really can accomplish on the .NET platform. And that's kind of sad.
Yes, I was having a conversation with a PM at Microsoft actually just this week about the web stack. And my feeling about the web stack is it'll never be any better than it is. It needs to be a lot better. It can be a lot better. But it means fundamentally rethinking the whole thing.
I'd like to actually ask Jeff a question about this because you guys, you know, talked about this implicit trust that you have for where Rails is going. And Jeff's been fairly critical on Twitter, at least, about some of the Rails 3 stuff and where they're going. So I'd like to get your perspective on this.
Yeah. And to Scott's point, I mean, one of the great things about I've found with the open source community is that it is a battle of ideas. And like, it's okay for me to go on Twitter and say what I think, because I know that it can have some effect. I know that what other people think will have some effect. And I don't have to wait for the mothership in the sky to magically send me a new version. So that's, but yeah, I've been so enamored with Rails for a long time. You know, for a variety of reasons, it's easy to set up on Windows. It's free. There's a large community now around it. It gives you a predefined architecture to just go with. It takes a lot of the religious wars out of the equation. You know, what's our folder structure going to be? All the stupid stuff that I used to have fun doing when I was a .NET developer, those are already decided, and I have to actually focus now on the important part of the work. You know, what is actually specific to my domain? I don't have to worry anymore about ORM choice or that kind of thing. But it is true that in the newer releases of Rails are coming out. Rails 3.0 is on the horizon now. I'm not thrilled with everything that's going on. I'm thrilled with much of it, but I think to some extent there's a tendency to try to get the largest audience possible, to be appealing to the enterprise corporate customer, which I don't particularly empathize with. And so naturally, I'm going to fight a little bit against some of the features going into Rails that are obviously slated toward that kind of customer. One of the reasons I switched away from .NET was because, you know, back in 2006, I wanted to maybe try my own hand at running my own company and build some websites. And there's no way I was going to try to pay those licensing fees for, you know, the entire web stack that you need in the database stack. And I could do it for free on open source. And I found that although I was very scared about moving away from .NET, I didn't know how I would get help. I didn't know where I would find documentation. I quickly found it. I kind of found that, there's a lot of online help available. People volunteer to help each other out. And it was just a wonderful cultural, shift and technical shift for me. So I don't know if that actually exactly answered your question, but...
Well, I think, yeah, it did. So you have not lost faith in the direction that Rails is going, I guess.
It's still hands down for me. The number one thing I would turn to if someone said, today, hey, I need you to build a web application for me. I mean, without a doubt. The rapid development, the ease with which I can do an agile style of development with Rails doesn't even compare to what you can do in .NET. I remember when I left .NET, I was trying to use NUnit, and it was like pulling teeth to try to get some sense from Microsoft and whether they would actually allow real developers to use some test first driven kind of style in Visual Studio. And I remember when the I think it was called the Visual Studio Express editions or something like that first came out, and it had some TDD in there. Oh, but not in the Express editions, because that's just like hobby developers. I was like, what hobby developers don't test? It was just ridiculous. And I found in the Ruby community, testing was like an assumption. I mean, when you generate a new model in Rails, it will create a skeleton test suite for you because it assumes that you should be testing as you go. So I just found a lot of synergy with the kind of way that I wanted to be a developer and fit better with the Rails mentality and the Ruby mentality, better than where the C# community was headed.
And I think that's a key differentiator. I mean, we can talk about how great the Ruby language is or how great Python is or how much you don't like Microsoft or you don't own it. Mm-hmm. But I think that the main thing that allows people to switch, and this comes back to kind of the issue of comfort, is Microsoft is a tools vendor. So all their development things come with tooling attached. In fact, if you try to get something implemented as a dev in the developer division at Microsoft without a tooling story, they look at you like you're nuts. And they try to constantly put a tooling story on top of it because you got to sell tools. Whereas with Rails and Python, Django, Cherry Pie, Google App Engine, those things tend to be more IDE agnostic. Mm-hmm. I find that's an interesting, because a lot of Rails devs at first, they all went with TextMate, and then TextMate kind of stopped releasing. And so now they're all kind of going towards Vim. Right. So yay! But the whole idea that they, you don't need an IDE to do all this stuff. In fact, there are IDEs out there. RubyMine comes to mind, NetBeans. But the Rails devs really don't care. And it's kind of the same with Python. They'll just open up in Vim or Emacs or whatever, and they'll just start writing. And with PHP, it's just a text editor on whatever platform you're on. And I think that's really the main thing that really gets you, that allows you to leave the .NET framework, is if you're comfortable working without an IDE.
No, I think you're exactly right. So one of the things I do is I go around doing training to .NET and Java shops who are curious about Ruby or they're trying to switch their team over to Rails. And one of the most difficult things I have to explain is that I'm not going to use an IDE with IntelliSense. And often they're like, what are you talking about? And so it's only after they literally watch me for an hour build a small web app without IntelliSense can they actually believe that it can be done. I mean, it's really amazing the addiction that we all get to like a Visual Studio IntelliSense. I remember when my first Rails app that I ever tried to write by myself back in the day was with Notepad on Windows. And I actually found myself, I would type something, I would type the dot, and I sort of paused for a second, expecting there to like be some drop down in Notepad. So I mean, I got so addicted to the whole IntelliSense thing that I just didn't know. I was afraid. What does that mean if you don't have that kind of IDE? But what I found was that my addiction to that IntelliSense was really not good for the way I would design my code. It forced a kind of bottom-up programming where you had to write your code sort of before you could write the test, because otherwise you wouldn't have it in your IntelliSense. And unless you're comfortable with writing your test and driving your code without that, you'll always be doing bottom-up design, which is not always what you should be doing.
And it's interesting. It's interesting, Jeff, that the extension of this is that you know, companies not recognizing that that this is happening, that IntelliSense, that code first or callee first rather than caller first design is the source of a lot of design problems. And then they look to other solutions like UML modeling, and, you know, let's get our higher level architect types to have UML because we need to get these designs right, because the designs are coming out crummy, and it's really not a problem that UML can solve, because right. it's still just this bottom up design being done by more senior people.
Right.
So rather than having senior people actually being able to teach other people how to do, you know, how to really do design.
That's absolutely right. And I think that one of the things that's also was a pleasant surprise for me when I started to learn Rails was that I could sort of keep in my head, you know, the top 10 methods I need to call an Active Record after a while. It's not too bad. Whereas in C#, I would still like have to hunt through. The surface area was so big on a lot of the methods and libraries. I was constantly hitting F1. Even though I was an experienced developer, I knew what to do. I just find that the Ruby language, it's English-like syntax. It's clearer style. The intent of your code is much clearer in your editor. That is actually more valuable than having the clutter of a statically typed language with IntelliSense.
That's a very, very hard sell, right? So it's a very hard sell not just to say, you know, if you change all the rules, especially the rules that tell you you need IntelliSense, then you actually won't need to use it to get productivity. And if you change all the rules of design, you might not actually need to have IntelliSense, because your APIs might actually just be incredibly intuitive.
Right.
And it's very hard to tell a .NET programmer that, because they simply can't imagine that that could possibly be true. It's trying to trying to explain Mozart to Helen Keller. I mean, you can only go so far before they say, you know, before they're in the back of their mind going, yeah, it really can't be that great. This guy's probably smoking some happy pills. The amazing thing about Ruby that I found when I first started using it is that the kind of functions that I would need to write using .NET to do the very mundane, very typical things that I would do to build an app are already in the standard library. Mm-hmm. It was amazing to find all of these things, the things that I needed, it was amazing to find them under my fingertips already. And then to go to Rails and see, you know, even more of that. And, you know, it's not all flowers and sunshine in Rails. There's some oddities in there and some non-Ruby-isms and, you know, some anti-Ruby idioms in there that are kind of wacky too. But it's amazing how much is really just there beneath your fingertips. And I think that, you know, when you change the rules, the necessity of things like IntelliSense and necessity of things like MSDN docs, you know, really just go away. And it's kind of, you know, you don't even notice it go away. You just sort of don't notice the fact that you're not needing any of this anymore, because the things that create those needs have never been created. You know, the obstructions never actually got into the framework or into the language.
Right. Well, and that's because Rails in general, but Ruby specifically, was never built to try and sell anything. It was really built to meet the needs of developers, right? I mean, that's the Ruby motto, right? Is,
well, Rails was built. Rails was built to sell something. It was built to sell an app and not a framework. And I think that's where when you're saying it's built for developer needs, that's how they built it. They grew it organically from their needs while they were building Basecamp and everything else that they need.
Well, you know, Rails was extracted from a working app. It wasn't built to serve the needs for an app. Right, it was what was needed and nothing beyond that. And that's why it's a joy to use, is because everything that you need is right there. And I think the philosophy of Ruby really informs a lot of what people like in Rails. And one of the things that I love about the Ruby philosophy is it is going towards minimalism, right? And you kind of see .NET as a flip side of that, where .NET is certainly not about minimalism. It's all about the kitchen sink. If you want something else, shove it in there, right? And that's the thing that is really driving me right now, is I just want to write the least amount of code that is possible. And I want it to look like it was written almost without thought, because it was so simple, right? And, you know, I agonize over, you know, trying to get a 12-line method down to 4, you know?
And, right. Without making it obscure.
Well, right. Without making it obscure. I'm not talking about golfing. I'm just right. talking about, like, finding the truth in the design, right? And yeah. I've never had a conversation about that with any .NET developer. I really had to kind of leave .NET, and I went to Ruby, but you can go to lots of other areas, lots of other communities, places outside of .NET, where they will have that discussion.
You know, it's this thing about, you know, it was something that you said, Mike, but it made me think that there's no real, you're talking about the framework being extracted out of an application. And here's, I think, a very stark contrast between the development of the Ruby on Rails framework and the development of the Microsoft frameworks. And it's one of the things that I think is the biggest weakness in Microsoft, and something that they really, really need to wake up to once Microsoft, you know, if Microsoft falls as far as IBM did, maybe they'll turn around and become a learning organization. And what I mean by that is there are no Rails committers that are not building businesses on web applications built on Rails. There are no Rails committers that aren't building applications in Rails. Well, that's a bit extreme. Maybe there are. But almost exclusively, people building .NET frameworks at Microsoft aren't actually building applications. And you see this with WPF, right? When did the first time that WPF really get a good looking at? That's when Microsoft sat down to write Visual Studio and realized that they needed to rewrite significant parts of WPF. Not before then. So, you know, the community was saddled with this other WPF for a couple of years before actual applications started to get built. And that simply doesn't happen. And I think that there's an amazing process in the Rails community, and it really has to go back to Ruby to do this. But one of the great things that I like about working in Ruby and Rails is if I find a part of the framework that I need to have behave a little differently, if I was adventurous enough, and many people become this adventurous inevitably, you modify the framework and you modify it non-destructively with dynamic programming or open coding. And those little mods tend to get out into the community, and they tend to be duplicated, and they tend to be copy and pasted code. And then those things become a plugin. And then those plugins get adoption, and those good plugins become part of the next framework rev. And this all happens because of open coding and because of modifications. And this happens not necessarily at a rapid pace. It happens at a very natural pace, but it's happening continuously and very naturally and organically. And the framework just grows based on merit. Meritorious ideas become little open-coded, monkey patches, if you would. And I don't say that as a bad term. Those things become plugins. The plugins become the next part of the framework. And all these significant advances in the framework, frameworks, basically, not just Rails, happen this way. And it's about how continuous it happens. Rather than it happening every 2 years when we're deciding to ship a whole new framework. Oh, and yeah, we can't ship until the IDE is ready, and we can't ship the IDE until we write the editor platform. And I mean, all this crazy sort of weird coupling that you get out of these big bang, you know, they make for really great launch parties, no doubt. I mean, I don't think the RailsConf is going to be as big as a Visual Studio launch, but, you know, I don't get my productivity from a party, really. So there you go. And it's funny, you know what, Jeff, maybe I don't know how it worked for you, but once you get into the Rails community are entrepreneurs. It's an interesting phenomena. I didn't plan to become an entrepreneur when I started doing Rails, but the more and more you hang out in the Rails community, the more you hang out with entrepreneurs, the more you get sucked in to seeing your ideas of building web businesses as truly viable, or at least you get you're constantly immersed in this, you know, group of people who are constantly working on their stuff, and they're building their businesses. Like every Rails developer is always building their side business.
Right. That is so true. I mean, ever since I got into it partly because I wanted to see if I could start my own business, and I didn't see the Microsoft stack as an economical one that I could afford. You know, so I started to look more closely at Ruby, and I found that, well, I wasn't the only one. A lot of people who were making the switch, it was because they wanted to venture out on their own, and both for economics and the appeal of the simplicity of the framework and for the friendliness of the Ruby community, it all kind of would gel. And you would find other people like you who are also trying to take a risk, whether it's with a business or just trying a new programming language. You know, since switching over to Ruby, I've met more people who know multiple programming languages. And that never happened to me when I was doing C#. I was, I mean, I was just in ignorance. I just, all my friends did C#, and I just did C#, and I knew about VB.NET, of course, but it's not really a different language. And then suddenly I'm talking to people who are doing some Erlang and Perl and Ruby and Python.
And they don't care. I mean, they don't have this, you know, like in the .NET community, you have this fear, like F#, oh no, I have to learn that. Oh, VB or C#. It's really amazing in the Rails community. Like people just don't have this fear of a new language. They're kind of like, well, that's a good thing to learn. I'm going to just go and do that. And it's almost there's almost a nonchalance around, you know, picking up a new language. And I don't think anybody picks up Erlang or Clojure and becomes a master at it. You know, they pick it up because they know that they've heard it's a good language for this certain type of problem, and they're going to look into it. And it is amazing. And I don't want to, it's not the polyglot thing. The polyglot thing, I don't think, is a goal in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I think the goal is solving the right problems, like with, you know, for example, functional language, or the way that GitHub turned to Erlang to get some performance increases on its messaging. It's just the fear of learning goes away. And I just think that's also in the culture. And if that fear isn't always being reinforced by the culture itself, then there's an unnatural level of fear, because fear is part of the cultural identity in the end, somehow in .NET, mm-hmm. Because we always are on what was pointed out as the technology treadmill. You know, you're trying to learn new APIs. You're trying to learn new APIs in the exact same paradigm where, you know, maybe a better solution is to switch paradigms, switch to functional, you know, switch to an actor-based model. What all these, you know, different choices. Yeah. I like that languages are often considered peer choices for alternatives rather than just switching APIs.
Well, I think it goes back to the tooling as far as the not learning other languages. So how many design services do we need that hide SQL away in, you know, Enterprise Manager or in Visual Studio? And how many times have they tried to smooth over JavaScript by creating a control library or something else?
But what does that teach .NET developers, right? It teaches them to fear. If Microsoft is trying to hide this, we really shouldn't be looking there. And it's really been a very unhealthy thing to reinforce. Because if you're in a community of learners, then, you know, the problem of learning really goes away.
It reinforces the lowest common denominator is what it really does.
And that's a really, really good way, and not to just be like an anti-Microsoft blah, 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 but it's a really, really good way to keep your captive audience. ASP.NET MVC is a fantastic, fantastic defensive marketing move on Scott Guthrie's part. He won with that move. You know, he took a group of people who were starting to look out and got them hooked back in at the last minute. And I you know, for me, it breaks my heart, because I wish for my friends, my .NET circle of friends, that they would really give a really hard, hard, hard look at the motives, the emotional motives that keep us doing these, you know, stuck in these patterns, and look elsewhere.
You know, Scott, I remember at the very first alt.NET conference in Austin, when Scott Guthrie showed the ASP.NET MVC framework that he was working on his laptop. And I remember the excitement in the room. And I asked him at that time, well, what about Iron Ruby? What about, you know, Iron Ruby on Rails? Why not just use Rails, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember being really surprised at the pushback to that idea. I mean, it had to be C#. And that's the big thing about it. If you want to use ASP.NET MVC, you have to use C#, because the biases of that language are riddled throughout that framework.
You know? And it does. It reinforces this. You know, you don't want to leave C#. You know, that's a really scary thing to inculcate into people. And, you know, I think that .NET devs should look at this question really hard, especially around MVC. Why not just use Rails? Here's an interesting thing about MVC. If you take a look around, especially today, as the Pragmatic Programmers publishers release their new monthly newsletter, they're taking a good honest look at MVC. And the tagline that is just starting to show up, and I don't know if it's a concerted effort to change the language, but guys from Microsoft are starting to refer to ASP.NET MVC as Rails on .NET. And first of all, that's disingenuous. It's not close. And secondly, doesn't ASP.NET MVC stand strong enough on its own brand that it does not have to refer to itself through another framework?
Well, for so long, it was ASP.NET MVC was so much more than Rails. It did so much more. It was so much better. It was going in a much different direction. It was solving problems that Rails wouldn't bother to solve.
And well, yeah, I mean, it's got a compiler, so you don't have, you know, you could, you know, ASP.NET MVC has solved the problem of compiling that, you know, Rails actually doesn't have. But, you know, I, frankly, you know, for everybody listening, I promise you, stake everything on it. ASP.NET MVC is not anywhere near the capabilities of Rails. And I don't, you know, I'm not asking for you guys to approve or believe that. My experience is looking at MVC that it's not just years behind in maturity, it's years behind in thinking. And I think it's important. I think it's important if you're going to stay with ASP.NET MVC to look at something that really, really, really just kicks its butt in terms of feature functionality capability and then go back to Microsoft and start demanding these things.
Well, let's let K. Scott ask Jeff one last question, because I think Jeff has to take off here pretty quick.
Okay.
And then the rest of us can blather on until, you know, daylight comes.
My wife will enjoy that.
Yeah. So, Jeff, thank you for being on the show. Do you have anything exciting coming up?
Do I have anything exciting coming up?
Sure.
Do you think that'd be a question I'd be prepared for, right? You know, I do not at the moment. I'm just trying to brace for Rails 3, reworking a lot of my training curriculum around it. Looking forward to it, but also trying to make sure that the voices are heard in the community as well.
Excellent. Well, feel free to keep jumping in if you're okay. Going to hang around a little bit.
Okay.
We'll have to wrap it up here pretty soon because we try to keep these things under an hour, but I think we're over that already. But I did want to bring up one point. Well, first of all, one thing we tried to do with the show is get a cross section of people. Like, it turns out we ended up with everyone who is fans of Ruby on Rails. Scott Kuhn tried to find some Python guys, but it turns out all the Python guys have never touched .NET. And, you know, we just didn't get anyone else. So a lot of what we've heard tonight has been about how great the Ruby language is, what a great framework Rails is. But one of the underlying currents that keeps coming up, I think that's a subtler issue, is things like when Mike said, well, I've never talked to a .NET developer about design. It's just, you know, just something that doesn't come up. It's everything's geared towards the lowest common denominator. And Jeff is surprised that .NET developers aren't hooked on testing tools. And Scott finds that going into the Ruby community, everyone's an entrepreneur. And I'm just wondering, Ruby's great, but how much of this push away from .NET for certain individuals is because of the culture? And again, this is something that I keep feeling as an underlying theme every time I get in one of the alt.NET type meetings, which is just people saying, you know, I'm fed up with my coworkers. I'm in this corporate IT department and people just want to bang out code inside of a click event for 8 hours and then punch out at 5 o'clock. And I'm looking for a different community that has the goals and common interests that I have. How much of it is
you're
related
to
that
meaning
versus technology, right?
Yeah, you're really looking for meaning. And to me, that's the beginning and the end of it. Yeah, it really does surprise me how quickly some developers are willing to just defer their career. You know, I mean, I'm going to spend, hopefully, you know, 40, 50 years of my life coding, you know, and some developers are just so willing to give the direction of that amount of time to someone else, you know. And this isn't about whether or not you're using Windows or using Linux or Mac or whatever. It's about owning your career, owning the direction of where you're going and what you're learning. And at some point in time, I was yearning for more. I remember the summer before I found Ruby, actually a couple months before I found Ruby, I was seriously considering just leaving programming altogether because I was really, really unhappy. It just didn't fulfill me like it did at the beginning. And then I kind of saw this Rails thing. I thought that's BS. And so I'll look into it enough to call BS on it. But what I found in Ruby was a way of approaching the art of programming that made me happy. And it just reinvigorated me and it kept me going. And then since that point in time, it's all been about trying to collect the weapons, collect the skills that I'm going to need to go into battle and to produce the best damn software ever made, you know? And there's just a lot of developers who don't want to see the world that way. And I think that's really, you know, what informs a lot of the choices that are made in the Ruby and the Rails communities is that outlook. And, you know, I would love it. I would have loved it if I could have found something comparable in the .NET space. But for whatever reason, there's something about the .NET community that pushes those types of people out.
You know, I don't really honestly know any .NET developers. You walk around tech ed, it's really hard to find a .NET developer who doesn't want to do good work, right? I mean, I do know that we do have the 9-to-5ers who clock out, but I think that comes from the burnout. You know, there's real burnout that comes from working with code and how difficult it is to deal with code that you don't have a safety net for, either through elegant design or testability, which is essentially, you know, a reflection of elegant design. You do burn out on that. And if you've never really been told that there's a better way, then you really start looking for a way out. You start looking for anesthetization. You start looking for ways to make this faster. And you start looking for ways to make your time easier, the time before you too get to become a manager.
I would just tag along, Mike, with what you were saying. I think that you and I ended up in a similar place, although we got there differently. I was seemingly happy in my C-sharp job. I mean, it wasn't like I was depressed about it and looking for something different. I got lucky that I happened to start to learn about Ruby from some other people. And I found that once I started to write a Rails application, I enjoyed it like so much more than I, you know, it would then with C-sharp or ASP.NET. And I wanted to do more of that because I enjoyed it. and that's what helped me get over the fear, was that I was like, wow, that's what I want to do for the next 12 months, not what I've been doing for the last 12 months. I found that there was a real fun aspect of programming again that I realized that I had lost. So even though I thought that I was, you know, relatively happy doing my enterprise-y kind of job, where really the next challenge was to learn about C-sharp 2.0 and to learn about C-sharp 3.0 and then learn about whatever. Here I was learning about entire worlds that I had no clue about before. And I found that that was really rewarding. That was worth stepping down the pay grades for. You know, that was worth trying to take some risks and go to a Google group and say, hey, I need some help. Because it was so fun to start to be able to develop websites in a more simple, faster, agile fashion. That's what helped me get over the fear.
Remember the first time you saw, you know, a plugin like R Magic for image magic and went, I can do what?
Exactly. That's right.
And it's already done for me, or, you know, Auth Logic, or any great Ruby plugin or any of the monitoring systems, or all of these things that are just ready to go, baked, ready to be plugged in. Not a lot of hacking needed. And it's just, when we talk about that ecosystem, we're really talking about ready-made modules. The thing that people talk about in .NET, being able to pull services off the shelf and use them. And, you know, they're still trying to get there, try to get to that world. And they're trying to really get there by creating, you know, and the answer is always, oh, well, WCF isn't ready yet. We need to rev it one more time before we get there. And it's kind of like, you know, kind of over here in this other world going, you know, we already do this services thing. I mean, we nailed it. I mean, it's ready to go. And most of this stuff's just free. And, you know, a lot of it doesn't actually need a whole book to learn how to use. It's just bang on.
Right. You know, and the other thing there is that not only can you get this free stuff that the community has built, but you get the source code. Mm-hmm. And one great way to learn something new is to look at how people better than you write code. I think it's really undervalued in the .NET community to learn how other people code. Mm-hmm. And I learned early on that, you know, for free, I could just at night start reading the Rails code. Like, wow, how did these guys connect to this table and do this stuff? And I could read that and learn.
I think that's also, I mean, it's funny because I still don't like doing that in .NET. And I find myself doing that in Ruby and in Rails. And, you know, I was reading the MERB source code just to see how they manage dependencies and stuff. But I do notice that I don't want to do that in .NET. And I think that's because, you know, not to just, you know, blow smoke up, you know, the Ruby language's proverbial pipe, but it is an easier language to read. And the community is very sort of, that culture is very focused on, you know, it's almost competitive in the Ruby culture to create clarity in code.
So am I the only one that goes out and learns stuff just because it's fun and not for a business reason?
I think you're rare.
I'm that way too.
I think you're rare.
Because I can remember installing Linux and trying PHP back when I was still doing VB6 programming. And you know, I'm still always trying crazy crap. I just tried installing Self on a Linux box the other day, the programming language, because I heard it was prototype, you know, it was the basis of the prototype inheritance in JavaScript. And I thought, well, let's go look and see what this does. And I don't know, maybe it's because programming is such a business now. And when I was learning it, you know, when I was a kid and in college and stuff, it was more, I don't know, I don't want to say bootstrapping, but you had to really love to do it, to want to do it, because it was so hard.
Well, I think it goes back to the burnout. I think it's really easy to get a sense that there's no answer. It's always going to be bad. There is no greener grass on the other side of the fence. And I honestly, Scott, I really think that you are non-representative.
I've been told that by many, many people in many, many situations.
And there's the kindest way he's ever been told that.
I think also one of the things that also, you know, for .NET developers switching over to Rails, I think one of the things you'll learn really quickly. I think I was an average programmer I was an average alpha geek, I guess, an average, you know, in the alt.NET thing when it was a thing and when it was the alpha geeks. I was an average guy in there. You know, I wasn't one of the leading thinkers, programmers or anything. When I got to Rails, it was immediately clear that I was incredibly outclassed by the majority of programmers I met, both as a programmer and as an operating systems guy and as a servers guy and as an architecture guy, as a caching guy and as a messaging guy. I mean, the people I was meeting were just incredibly experienced beyond what I would see. And this was just sort of on average. There was a larger average of the high-end thinkers. And also the incredible thing is there's just a different culture. I mean, you can actually learn from those people, where sometimes some .NET alpha geeks can be kind of intimidating. And I think it's to the Ruby culture's credit specifically that there's not really a lot of intimidation amongst the intelligentsia of the Ruby world. And there's a lot to learn, and there is a lot to learn. And there's people there who are, for all intents and purposes, incredibly intimidating. But, you know, there's a friendliness, and it's difficult for me often to even interact in the Ruby community, because I'm, you know, I've been trained by the not.NET community that it's, you know, rough and tumble, you know, brawl and fight most of the time.
You know, one of the things that really intrigued me about the Ruby language when I came on, because I really saw a lot of the Rails invasion coming into the Ruby community. And the Ruby community has changed a lot from where it was in, you know, 2004, 2005. But one of the most interesting things to me at the time is if you go and look at agilemanifesto.org, at the original signers of the manifesto, and it's like a who's who of the Ruby community, right? Mm. These people were in it before Rails, and they were in it for a reason, right? And I think it's a good exercise to try and figure out why they were interested in it in the early 2000s. But you're talking like Martin Fowler, Andy Hunt, Brian Merrick, Bob Martin, Dave Thomas. These guys signed the manifesto, and they were active and involved. Well, I'm not sure about Bob Martin, but, you know, those other guys were involved in Ruby. They were part of it, you know. They were contributing code. They were, you know, advancing the state of the art.
I think it was recently, within the past week or so, that Bob Martin said on one of his status updates on Twitter that he was just finishing up some work, and then it was off to do some real work in Rails. and I think that's an interesting, you know, it's okay. It's a bit of a cheesy quote. It's not meant to convince the world. But I think what's important about that is I think Bob had also said, you know, not longer than 2 years ago, that he really wasn't too terribly interested in Rails and Ruby at that time because of the lack of significant automated refactoring support. And I think that, you know, and I don't want to put words in Uncle Bob's mouth, and I'm doing this secondhand a little bit, and that might be underhanded, but if you can see a guy like Uncle Bob, and you're a C# developer, and you're, you know, one of the intelligentsia, and you're totally into the solid movement, and you live and die by Uncle Bob's acronyms, then consider the fact that, you know, even one of these great stalwarts of static design patterns is taking a look at this stuff now and seeing something worth merit, at least worth something to get used to. And it doesn't depend on IntelliSense, and it doesn't depend on automated refactoring. Because, like I said, when you change the rules, some of the tools you need to uphold your current paradigm won't be as necessary.
And this talk about tools, it's not all about .NET either. There's a lot of Rubyists who've come to it from Java, and they'll say the exact same things, right? I mean, this whole notion of ceremony, right? This whole notion of ceremony in code and writing things that really don't convey your intent, they're there just to make the compiler happy, you know? That's a problem everywhere, you know? I think a lot of programming is trying to push the complexity to where it makes the most sense. And unfortunately, with .NET and with Java, there's a lot of complexity that just doesn't make sense anywhere. And so you're going to add additional complexity to kind of work around it. Right.
And honestly, I think I can't but think that that happens when you have programmers who are not programming applications, programming tools for people who are programming applications.
To sell tools.
Well,
it's to get sold.
That's probably in there. But I'm saying there's a very, very serious problem with people making tools for people who do things when the people making the tools don't actually do those things. You're never going to get a great tool from a tool maker who only makes tools. You have to buy your tools. You have to buy your guitar from someone who knows how to play the thing.
Or make your own.
And the people, you know, well, some of the greatest guitar players, you know, inevitably become guitar designers. And it's you know, it's like that. I mean, you've got to be really, really careful when you think that you can go to a company that doesn't, you know, who's the majority of their programmers simply don't do what you do and expect them to be able to help you to do what you do.
All right. And with that, I think we're just going to have to wrap, unfortunately. We could keep going for hours, but people can only take a podcast for so long.
But you're recording this on cassette tape, and there's 90 minutes, and that's...
That's right. I think Kevin got his Commodore 64 out for this one and got Skype running on it.
He's already had to flip the tape recorder over once.
So, Mike, anything coming up for you? Anything exciting going on?
No, I have nothing exciting.
Nothing exciting?
No, I'm not. All right. I'm not an exciting person.
Not even a Mountain West Ruby something or other? Nothing?
No, we had Mountain West in March, and I'm still trying to get all the videos produced and the post-conference magazine out, so just a lot of bookkeeping type stuff for me. But yeah, I have nothing to sell. I have nothing to hawk or anything.
What about you, Mr. Bellware?
I am steadily working as an independent, building Rails apps for independent startups, self-funded startups, and I've got the entrepreneur bug, and I've got a couple partners together from actually a couple partners in the .NET community, as a matter of fact, and we are in stealth mode working on a product in Rails. And I'll be at the Norwegian Developers Conference with you, Scott, I think in a couple of weeks.
That's
and we'll
correct.
Be doing there's a Ruby meetup that we'll be doing with a bunch of .NET Rubyists, and we've got an open source party happening on the Wednesday night, which I hope to see you at.
Oh yeah, that'll be cool. I look forward to that.
Oh, you know what? I do have something to pitch. I just remembered. I'm actually speaking at Agile Roots, which is a conference in Utah on June 14th and 15th. And I went last year. It was a terrific conference, and I'm actually speaking this year. So there you go.
Very cool.
Oh, may I say one more thing? I don't want to trump Mike. But we're also planning. We're also in the planning stages right now of another open source conference for .NET developers that should happen in the fall in Boston. It'll be under the Monospace name, but it's basically the second annual conference on open source in .NET.
Oh, very cool.
So look for news at monospace.us.
All right. Thanks for a great show, guys.
Thank you.
And we'll. See you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, Jeff, are you guys planning on doing any other books? Are you done?
Rails 3 for Rails 2 devs?
You know, right. You know, we have had, you know, it's been suggested that we update the book for Rails 3. The problem is that we've had two moving targets. One is .NET. Mm-hmm. I guess now it's up to like 4.0 or something, and Rails as well. So I'm just not sure it makes a lot of sense. But I'm looking at Mac Ruby, and I'm starting to sketch out an outline for a book for that. So
you know, I read the book, and
I have to say that like the Rails material in that book was awesome. Like I felt like the here's how you do it in .NET stuff was actually not really that necessary from my perspective. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. No. I hear that. And sometimes it was hard to actually come up with the equivalents. We were just trying to find some way. You know, someone's going to say, "Look, I usually drag a data grid. How the heck do I do this in Rails?"
Right.
But I definitely hear you. You know, there's only so much choices you can make in the book. You know, unfortunately.
I'd like to see a book about Ruby code written written in a C# style. I think that would be very amusing.
Ruby code in a C#. That is interesting.
I've got 2 years worth of Ruby code that does that.
What? I can put a question mark in a method?
The thing that kills me about writing Ruby and writing Python is that coming from C# and VB6 before that, I'm always expecting that I have to write more than I actually do.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I get down and I've written like 3 lines of Python code. I'm like, I'm missing something.
There's
something I'm not doing here.
There's almost a level of over formality or over elaboration in C# code that's really hard to get over when you start seeing like the Ruby idioms. Like my first look at the Ruby idioms is like, well, this method is just got an, it's just named a, the name of this method is a noun. It needs a verb. And, you know, you're sort of like stuck in this static programming culture formalism where you're not really seeing the sort of language orientation or the elegance of the API. And you're like, well, you know, here's a method. So I got to put a verb on it. It's a fluent interface. So I need to have a preposition in here, either a to, a for, an and, or an of. You know, that's not really, I was saying this, it's not really, those aren't really fluent interfaces as much as they are dramatic interfaces.
Hey, did you say that conference was going to happen in Boston?
Yes, yes.
Okay. And did you say there's a date already for that? Or?
The date should be somewhere close to the end of October or the beginning of November.
Okay. Is there any chance I could propose to do a talk? Or I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Because I guess I missed the first one, but that sounds like an awesome idea. So
yeah, we did it last year and it was small and quiet and it was just, we tried it, you know, tried a little experiment and we think it went really well.
What was it last year?
It was in Austin.
Was it? Yeah.
Yep. And the Mono project and the Mono guys have a big role in this conference. But it's not just a Mono conference. It's, you know, they have a big role to play in this because, you know, if you want to talk about open source .NET, like the version of .NET of all of .NET or the core that is open source is a pretty big topic. But this is really going to be geared as, you know, the annual conference on open source and .NET. And hopefully, you know, we can sustain it year after year. So, you know, it becomes a gathering place for people actually doing stuff and also a gathering place for people doing, you know, MSPL and CodePlex and the whole tribe of people. I mean, the interesting thing about open source and .NET is there are actually different open source cultures. And it's weird. It's very unique to Microsoft, I think, that our open source community is actually different communities.
You know, I had an idea real quick. I wouldn't mind getting your feedback just real quick on it. When I was interviewing for the position I'm in now, I talked to a Windows guy, .NET guy, and we were kind of talking about where Mono was, and then also kind of the JVM and how Google is using it with Android. And what they've done with Android is just taken the entire standard library and like thrown it out and built their own. And, you know, that's what Android is. What do you guys think about starting over with a new standard library on top of Mono? Thanks, Jeff.
A standard library of what?
I'm saying get rid of system dot completely and just starting over, right? I mean,
just get rid of the BCL and keep the language mean.
Yeah, get rid of the BCL. You know, all that stuff about ASP .NET being difficult to test, right? It's difficult to drive your applications when you're built on top of that on that stack because it was never built for testing. And they're never going to add testing the way they need to because they're going to break backwards compatibility. So why not just start over?
Well, I totally think that Microsoft needs to start from scratch on the web stack, like just completely pave it and go again.
Well, why not start over from everything though? I mean, why not just say this is a great technology, we like the runtime, we like, you know, the tools that we have. You could still use all the same tools. I mean, the infrastructure is still there, but just compile against a completely different set of assemblies.
Well, that's certainly not what Mono does, because they maintain compatibility with core.NET. But I think that, Mike, if you want to spend the time doing that, I will certainly read your blog posts about it.
That's what I thought you guys were going to say. I think it's an intriguing idea. I would love to see something like that happen, but I'm certainly not interested in doing it.
C# used elsewhere. Well, you know, maybe is Mono Touch like that?
I don't know.
You know, is Mono Droid going to be like that?
No, they include big chunks.
Well, they compile to native. Well, I don't know about Mono Droid, but Mono Touch.
Right,
but it still includes all the
system
VCL system. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I mean, you're really like it's a different. Yeah. That's probably not in the spirit of what Mike's talking about. It really is different.
But I guess the you know at this point is are statically typed languages just the past? Like, does it even make sense to start over?
That's kind of what I'm wondering.
I just don't know that they're dead yet.
they'll never be dead. They'll never die. Yeah. But I don't think that's where the energy's been the last few years.
Statically typed languages have not gotten the message yet. Get it?
We're just not that into them.
I intentionally didn't go into the whole static versus dynamic because I think that's been done to death.
You know, I think once you're playing around with, you know, even JavaScript should show you. I mean, I think Ruby is a lot easier to deal with than JavaScript. That, you know, once you start going like, why the fuck do I need generics and interfaces? All I'm trying to do is call a method.
Exactly.
What the hell are we doing? How much work do you have to put in to calling a method before you can call a method? And how much angle, because you know, I said this before, it's like we've already decided that angle brackets are no good, and then we put them in C#.
Don't even get me started on generics and the anonymous functions. Oh god.
Somebody
asked on Twitter, they said, I think it was Rob Connery, so he said, is the dynamic keyword going to bring them back? I was like,
no. The dynamic keyword is I think it's like trying to get your lover back after you've punched them in the face.
I was going to say it's like trying to fit in your high school jeans, you know, because VB6 used to do that kind of dynamic late binding stuff and it did it right, and mm-hmm. now they're trying to shoehorn it in, and it's either going to be horribly abused or actually the one thing that I fear more than anything, it won't be here until at least C#5, and that's the eval and the whole compiler as a service thing. That is going to be such a gopher suck in .NET. We're going to see so many apps that are stored in databases as strings and then evaled.
Oh man, that's horrifying. That is horrifying.
And we've already got .NET devs packing HTML into, you know, NText tables. It's bad enough.
Wow. So my Silverlight app is just an eval. Good, I would really love to hear a show about Node that doesn't talk about, that never says evented IO. I would really like to hear a show about Node that says, here's what I can do, and here's what I'm doing with Node, and here's why the architecture, you know, is interesting. And at the end, maybe say the words evented IO, but I'd really love to hear somebody talking about, like...
So if you haven't already, you should follow Vision Media on GitHub.
Okay.
And he's on, I think his name is TJ Holowaczek. I'm going to get that name wrong. I don't really know him. I just know him from Twitter. And I was using his JSPEC. BDD style kind of...
The Java and JavaScript?
Yeah. Using that for a while. Anyway, he's been just full on Node for a while now. He's got a Sinatra-like framework built on Node. He just built a TDD kind of thing, Node module.
Oh, is he the one who wrote Express?
Yeah, he's the one that wrote Express. And he's doing lots of crazy stuff with Node and
TDD framework for Node. I can probably figure out Node from that. There's a sort of basis that I could understand, perhaps.
Yeah. So if we were going to talk about Node, we'd have to still mention evented IO, because I watched a video of the creator, Ryan mm-hmm. Dahl, I think that's his name.
Yep.
And he basically stood up there at, I think it was at Yahoo or Google or one of those places, and said, we've been thinking about IO completely wrong for all these years. we've had things waiting on things to, you know, other things to finish, and we just need to do it with callbacks and do it async.
Are you guys also looking at the Microsoft reactive framework for JavaScript? Any sort of feeling about what that is and whether it matters?
Yeah, I think I've looked at it.
We did a show on that, man.
We did, yeah.
Is that up? Is that up yet?
Yeah, that's up. Okay. It's the one with Matt Podwasaki and Jeff, what's his name, from the team? Eric Meyer's team. Van Gogh.
Oh, I did.
Right.
Yeah, no. That's right. I heard that show. That's probably where I got the question from.
Yeah. Yeah, it's gonna take a while to sink in, but I think if any community is going to adopt it wholeheartedly, it'll be the JavaScript community. I don't think .NET is going to really pick up on reactive until it's baked in and there's a tool. When there's a reactive framework designer surface, then they'll pick up on
it. Reactive framework. The reactive framework for entity framework.
Yes.
RxEF.
But when I look at really smart guys like Oren, you know, doing these huge nested callbacks and complaining because there's no real easy way to refactor it, and then you see what Matt Pawasaki is doing by just kind of chaining these things together, and the way that Reactive lets you do that, you say, you know, Oren's code could be so much cleaner if he was using the Reactive framework for this. And I think that I see this a lot in Node.js code as well. And so I kind of think they're a perfect fit.
Hmm.
Kind of peanut butter and chocolate, but not really so much peanut butter or chocolate. It's more like chocolate with a chocolate truffle filling.
Nice. I like peanut butter and chocolate together. So if it's a vented peanut butter and chocolate, I suppose that's better. Because I've been thinking about Reese's Pieces all wrong. I got the peanut butter in the chocolate, and what I really need to do is have the peanut butter as a callback.
See, that was the biggest problem with Reese's Pieces. It was all peanut butter, no chocolate. What the hell? Only an alien would like that. That's why E.T. liked it.
Do you guys have you guys been looking at CoffeeScript? Do you have any feelings about that, like writing JavaScript in Ruby or Python?
No, CoffeeScript is something different. It's its own syntax. Yeah, it's kind of a semi-functional syntax. I know some guys that are really, really big into it. I haven't looked at it other than, you know, going to the website and going, huh, and then going on.
Yeah, I like it, but I haven't used it in any seriousness.
Have you tried it on Node?
No. And I've heard some people, the people that are really into it, are saying, you know, this is perfect for Node. I'm like, oh, okay. Maybe I'll look into it.
God, I got to catch up on all this shit. You guys, I got to run into you guys at some point just to pick your hard drives.
So I tried finding Python programmers for this, but apparently you either start with Python or you start with C and then go to Python. There is no Windows. In the middle, there's like two people writing Iron Python code, and they pretty much, you know, we couldn't really say that they left .NET.
Right.
And the only other people I know are pretty much Mac programmers hardcore. So.
Right.
No, actually, that's why we don't have John on this call, is because he works for Microsoft. And, well, one, he's like traveling crazy now this summer because of the webcam stuff, and he couldn't make it anyway.
Mm.
But it was also that he kind of felt like he didn't mind being the whipping boy for Microsoft, but he didn't want to, you know, he'd feel like he'd kind of have to defend or and he didn't want to distract from the conversation.
Really?
If he was kind of, you know, the token Microsoft employee who has to defend anything that we say about Microsoft.